Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. My guest today is Arnie Gundersen, an old friend, an energy advisor with Fair Winds Associates, a company which provided research, analysis and paralegal services around environmental and energy issues and still does. Arnie Gundersen has a 39-year history of nuclear power engineering experience. And during his nuclear industry career, Arnie managed and coordinated projects at 70 nuclear power plants around the US. He currently speaks on television, radio and at public meetings on the need for a new paradigm in energy production. An independent nuclear engineering and safety expert, Arnie provides testimony on nuclear operations, reliability, safety and radiation issues to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the US, congressional and state legislatures and government agencies and officials throughout the US, Canada and internationally. Arnie Gundersen, welcome again to If You Love This Planet.
Hi Helen, thank you for having me.
Now Arnie, as we know, the Fukushima drama disaster continues apace. Will you please give us an update on where everything is at this particular point in time?
Sure, let's start right on the site. Tokyo Electric released a report this week that says that if there was a strong earthquake or another tsunami, the piping that they put in to keep the reactors cool is really not capable of withstanding an earthquake or a tsunami, and they estimate that it would be about 38 hours before they would have meltdowns. So,
oh, really? Another meltdown?
Yes. You know, there's still that decay heat, and there will be decay heat. After the nuclear fission has stopped, there's still radioactive material in the core, and it's radioactively hot, but it's also physically hot. And Tokyo Electric has done the calculations, and they show that they'd have less than 2 days to get the piping back and working again, or else they'd have more of a meltdown. They could not cool the core, and whatever hasn't melted down would. So I thought, you know, that's an indication that it is still a dangerous place to be.
Things are very tenuous, aren't they?
Yes. So that's the three units that have nuclear fuel in the core, Unit 1, Unit 2, and Unit 3, that applies to. On Unit 1, there's some good news. They were able to put, it looks like a substantial building, but actually it's a tent over top of the reactor building.
Tent made of plastic, isn't it? Isn't it a plastic tent?
Yes, it's made of plastic. And they did it with remotely controlled cranes so that it was so radioactive they didn't want to get people give people a high dose. And they built this tent over the top of the entire unit one. Now what that does is they can then connect it to the stack. And instead of releasing the radioactivity at the ground level, they'll run it up through filters and then up the stack. They're not there yet, but they're close to having the stack connected.
So what good is that, for God's sake? I mean, the radiation is still getting out into the environment. It's going up the stack a bit higher to be deposited far and wide over Japan. I can't understand why that's a good thing. Why would they do that?
Before it does, you know, dispersion is the solution to pollution.
No, it's not. Dilution, the solution to pollution by dilution when it comes to radiation is fallacious because it lands on the soil and reconcentrates in the food chain. So,
the other thing they're doing, though, Helen, is to give them credit, they are running that through a filter first.
Oh.
So instead of it being unfiltered, they will filter it and then what what gets through the filter now will go up the stack as opposed to be at ground level.
Well,
what
isotopes can they filter out then with the filter?
Depends on the size of the particle.
Yeah.
And a lot of these particles are quite small. At best, they'll get 90% of them, but that's not bad. If the particle size is very small, it will go right through the filter. So that's still part of the ongoing science project we call Fukushima. It doesn't stop the liquid either. The liquid releases are, again, becoming very problematic. And I'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
Unit 2 and Unit 3, pretty much the same. Gases, radioactive gases and radioactive steam, are leaking out of the building. And what that says is that somewhere the containment is broken. There should be, if the containments were functional, you shouldn't see steam coming out of those plants, even though the building around it, that's called the reactor building, even though the reactor building is damaged. But it's obvious the containments have been broken and steam is exiting. That shouldn't happen. To get to the liquids, though, what the problem is, they're generating more and more and more very radioactive liquid. What's happened is they put in a system to filter the radioactive liquid. Then they pump it back into the nuclear reactor, and it runs onto the floor, and then they collect it and they filter it, and it runs back into the plant. And that was supposed to reduce the amount of water that they had on site, or at least not make it get any worse. But what they found is that something on the order of 400 tons a day of water are leaking into the building. So from groundwater and from rain and from cracks in the building, not only do they have the water that they deliberately put there, but they also have 400 tons a day that's leaking in. So now they've got almost no place to store the water on site. They're cutting down a forest on site, and they're putting more and more tanks in, so that they have a place to store all this radioactive water. That's going to continue for months, if not a year or more, until the cooling of the core becomes easier. Their biggest problem, if they don't have an earthquake, their biggest problem is managing this water. Getting down to Unit 4, Unit 4 has been pretty thoroughly braced. They sent people in and put braces underneath the nuclear fuel pool because they, like I, were very worried that in an earthquake the building would collapse. It's better now, but if there was a severe quake, the most dangerous thing on the site is the fuel pool for Unit 4. So things are stable. The radiation releases are much lower than they were back when the accident started. But they're still precarious if Mother Nature decides to get angry again.
Arnie, you said that Building 4, yeah, they've braced the pool to make the pool more stable, but that the building itself is still quite precarious. And you've said that if there was another earthquake, it's possible that Building 4 could collapse with the cooling pool on top of it. Is that still accurate or not?
Yes, that's absolutely accurate. And I have told my friends in Japan, if there's an earthquake that knocks over Building 4, get out of Dodge, because it's not a place you would want to be. No science has ever been developed to calculate what radioactive material lying on the ground outside the power plant could conceivably do. The Brookhaven study back in 98 estimated that a fire in a fuel pool like Unit 4 could kill 186,000 people. So it's clearly, let's pray there's no earthquake, but a big earthquake. But it's clearly the biggest danger on site right now.
Okay, now the next question is, to filter the water and to filter the air coming out of Unit 1 from the plastic tent, what do they use for filters? What's the material, A, and B, what do the filters trap in terms of specific isotopes? And C, what do they do with these incredibly toxic radioactive filters, and how long do they last?
Well, the radioactive filters collect predominantly cesium, but also the strontium and any other radioactivity, cobalt-60 and things like that. And you're absolutely right. Very quickly, they become the most highly radioactive filters that anyone in the industry has ever dealt with. Now, these are from a design that the French use on their reprocessing plant. Essentially, you're dealing with reprocessed nuclear fuel in these filters. They're also going to have plutonium in them. And because the fuel is now lying in the bottom of the containment buildings, there's water over the top, and the contamination will also include plutonium. So I think they have to be stored on site until the Japanese come up with a long-term geologic repository for the nuclear fuel. And that's, you know, they're 20 years away from being able to peel off the nuclear fuel from the floor in the turbine in the containment building. So they have a serious long-term storage problem for the filters, we'll need a special, very well-shielded building to make sure that radioactive material doesn't get so radioactive that it would be impossible to get near it on site.
Well, TEPCO apparently today, just a few hours ago, Arnie Gunderson, came out with a statement saying it's going to take 30 years for them to clean up this mess. That was just a few hours ago that TEPCO made that announcement.
It doesn't surprise me. You know, the problem is if they had attacked it early on with ferocity nationwide, they might have had an easier time cleaning it up than they have now. We have this game called whack-a-mole here in the U.S., and you can imagine 7 or 8 holes, and this mole sticks its head up, and you try to hit the mole. And
oh, whack-a-mole. That's horrible, honey.
Well, you try to hit the mole, and he jumps down, and he pops up in another hole, and then you hit that hole, and he jumps up in another hole. That's what's happening in Japan right now. Because they don't have a process that systematically went at the radiation, they are... they're struggling because they'll attack it where it pops up, and then they'll go attack it where it pops up. And the process is cheap, and Tokyo Electric is really unwilling to spend what it's going to take to clean up. But I think because they're trying to minimize their costs now, they're actually going to make the problem more costly and more time-consuming in the future. It doesn't surprise me that they said 30 years. I've been saying 20 all along. There's no technology to deal with removing the nuclear fuel from these buildings.
The melted fuel.
Melted nuclear fuel from these buildings. Now, Three Mile Island had melted nuclear fuel, but it all stayed in the nuclear reactor vessel.
Mm.
And what they could do then is flood the nuclear reactor vessel and go in and, with tools, remove the nuclear fuel. Well, here, they can't flood the nuclear reactor vessel because it's leaking.
Mm.
It's leaking in several places. And so in order to flood the nuclear reactor, they have to flood the whole containment. And that becomes a structural problem. This building was never meant to hold that much water. And in an earthquake or just general issues, it could collapse. So they need an entire new approach to get enough water in to shield the people to remove the fuel. And then it's lying like a pancake on the bottom. You know, when you overcook a pancake in a frying pan, how hard it is to peel the pancake off the frying pan.
Yeah.
It's going to be like that on the floor of the nuclear reactor. So it's not gonna give up easily.
Well, and I mentioned to you recently that, you know, they said by the end of the year, the three units will be in cold shutdown. But you said that's not true, because cold shutdown means that the fuel is still in the reactor core in a geometrical design as it was originally designed to be. But this is like a molten pancake, on the bottom of the containment vessel. So you would deny that these three reactors are in cold shutdown, right, Arnie?
That's right. That was a great explanation, by the way. The concept of a cold shutdown means that the nuclear reactor is actually containing the nuclear fuel, which isn't the case here. And now they may hold the water at less than 100 degrees centigrade, but that doesn't mean that the fuel, because it's in a big lump on the bottom of the reactor, is going to be at 100 degrees. And the concept of cold shutdown really means that the entire system is at 100 degrees. And because this is a big lump somewhere in the core is in the reactor or on the floor outside the reactor, that concept is... it sounds nice, but really it's a meaningless concept.
Yeah, and the lump is about 100 tons, is it?
At least 100 tons, yeah. In each reactor.
In each reactor, so that's three. That's unbelievable. Now, I've checked with you again and again, Arnie, and you keep saying that the daily atmospheric release from those three reactors is 12,000 trillion becquerels of radiation a day, and a becquerel is a disintegration per second of radiation. Now, do you still stand by that, or what would you say the release, and it's, of course, it's an estimated release because they're not really measuring it per se, but what do you say now, Arnie?
Well, of course, now that they've wrapped up Unit 1, there's less releases, and hopefully when the filters turn on, there'll be less releases. I think it's, they said it was around 13 billion becquerels per day. And
terabecquerels, they said.
13 trillion.
Yeah, trillion.
Becquerels per day.
Yes.
With a T. And now I think it's down to about 10.
10.
That's a lot of radiation even now, but compared to, of course, what it released in the at the beginning, it appears to be much lower. In fact, if any plant released that kind of radiation under normal circumstances, it would be shut down. So they seem to be happy with the number. But again, if it was any other plant in the world, it would be shut down.
It's unbelievable. Now, so you sent me a report the other day, and I can't remember who wrote it. I should have looked at this, about xenon-133 and cesium-137 releases into the atmosphere from Fukushima. And they said that, regarding xenon-133, which is called a noble gas, and I can explain that to the audience in a minute, what that means, we find a total release of 16.7 E becquerels, which is the largest radioactive noble gas release in history, not associated with nuclear bomb testing. There is strong evidence that the first xenon-133 release started very early, possibly immediately after the earthquake, and the emergency shutdown on 11th of March at 6 a.m. The entire noble gas inventory of reactor 20 units, 1 to 3, that's 1, 2 and 3, was set free into the atmosphere between the 11th of March and the 15th of March 2011. The largest release in history. Do you want to comment on noble gases, Arnie, what they are and what that would have meant to the population of Japan?
Yeah, noble gases are in the fuel, but they're held inside the fuel as long as the zircaloy cladding is in place. But what that report, and it's a phenomenal report, it's breathtaking in its analysis. What that report says is that the fuel failed very soon after the earthquake. You know, they were seeing it within the very first hour. And that leads, a lot of us have thought that Unit 1 had problems right from the get-out, that it wasn't the tsunami, but Unit 1 had fuel problems and was in a meltdown condition even before the tsunami hit. And that confirms it. When they saw early releases of xenon-133, that means that the clad broke, and it's a noble gas, so it just goes right out. It's not captured in the water. It's not captured in the air, and it goes right out. Then later, probably 3, 4, 5, 10 hours later, as the fuel failed in units 2 and 3, they had additional spikes of xenon gases. What it does is it's a cloud. It's a xenon cloud that moves with the weather, and it bombards people with external gamma rays, which are really powerful X-rays. The predominant exposure from from these are that they bombard people with X-rays. They also then, as they decay, they turn into iodine-133 or strontium-90. There's a krypton-90 decays to strontium-90. So there's other isotopes that then have a second shot at you. But the noble gases are a cloud that bombards people from the outside. We found that after Three Mile Island, a dramatic increase, a measurable, statistically meaningful increase in lung cancer in people that were in that cloud. That shows up about 3 to 5 years after the accident.
Yeah, xenon actually converts and decays to cesium, and krypton decays to strontium. So let me explain what noble gases are from a biochemical and medical perspective. Noble gases do not combine chemically in the body, but they are absorbed actually through the lung. And I used to use xenon for ventilation perfusion scans in my cystic fibrosis patients to see what areas of their lung were all clagged up with pus and collapse of the lung, and what areas were still being ventilated and perfused with blood. But the noble gases, xenon, krypton, and argon, are in fact absorbed from the lung, and we use xenon these days to measure fatty deposits in the body, because xenon, well, they're very fat-soluble, so they tend to go and dissolve in the fatty deposits of the body, which are mainly located in the abdomen and upper thighs, which is exactly where the gonads, the testicles and ovaries, are situated. And because you talked about they give out huge doses of what you would call X-rays, gamma rays, they are bombarding the genes in the eggs and sperm with radiation, which can induce mutations and cause down the time track through generations genetic diseases such as cystic fibrosis, diabetes, hemochromatosis, dwarfism, inborn errors of metabolism, phenylketonuria. In fact, there are 2,600 such diseases. And it's important to know, for people to know, that evolution took place when the Earth was much radiologically hotter. And so mutations occurred which were advantageous to an environment, like fish develop lungs and birds develop wings. But the truth is, most mutations are deleterious. They cause disease. Very few are advantageous. And, of course, evolution took place over eons and eons and eons of time. But what we're doing by fissioning atoms in nuclear power plants and bombs is increasing dramatically the background level of radiation in a most artificial way, which will inevitably induce deleterious mutations, which will be passed on through the generations and cause, if you like, random compulsory genetic engineering. So people need to know what these noble gases are and what they do, and that they are also not just released during an accident, but they're released continuously from reactors. They're called routine emissions. Like, don't worry about it. They're just routine, you see. But if you live near a reactor, you could be immersed, depending on inversion systems and meteorological conditions, in clouds of xenon, krypton, and argon. And as you just said, Arnie, they decay to other nasty things like strontium and cesium. So it's important for people to understand that. But my question now to you, Arnie, is the total release of xenon was 16.7 E-becquerels. What's an E-becquerel? What are E-becquerels? What's the number? What does that mean?
It should have been 16. E means 10 to the power.
Oh.
And there should be a number after that E.
Oh.
I have a hunch that the document you're reading from doesn't, there must be a typo in there. It would be 16 with 10 to the power number of zeros behind it.
All right. Well, now then we go on in the same paper to cesium-137. And it says, this paper says, a total emission of cesium-137 was 35.8 P becquerels. P for Paul. And I need to refer people to what that paper is. And in fact, I've got my computer here. I can look it up here because I took it from something you sent me yesterday, Arnie, which was incredibly important. It comes from the atmospheric chemistry and physics discussions. That's the atmospheric chemistry and physics discussions, volume 11, 2011. And the name of the paper is Xenon-133 and Cesium-137 releases into the atmosphere from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, determination of the source term, atmospheric dispersion and deposition. That people can look it up and get the actual data. So, yeah, okay, Arnie, let's go on to Unit 4.
That same paper, you know, we all know that Unit 1, 2, and 3 melted down. The Tokyo Electric is saying that the Unit 4 pool always had water over the top of it. And, of course, I've been saying that's not the truth. I'm not saying it boiled dry, but I am saying that the top of the nuclear fuel was definitely exposed as all that heat boiled off the water. But what the paper showed is that when TEPCO finally got the fire hoses and finally sprayed water into that pool, the radioactive releases dropped dramatically. So the paper supports my position that the fuel was uncovered, that the cladding broke at the top and released things like cesium-137 into the atmosphere. So the paper actually says that the biggest source of radiation was likely to be the Unit 4 fuel pool. So that's another problem with this Mark 1 containment and Mark 1 fuel pool, that the fuel pools are so highly radioactive that an event that doesn't even dry them out, but an event that causes them to boil to where the top of the fuel is covered, can release enormous amounts of radiation.
But didn't you show a video, Arnie Gunderson, some time ago of the explosion at Unit 4 pool, which you thought might be an excursion or, in fact, that it reached critical mass at some point? Wasn't that the Unit 4 fuel pool?
That was the Unit 3 fuel pool.
Unit 3.
The dramatic explosion that has the enormously high cloud is the Unit 3 fuel pool. And you're right, though. I do believe that it was something we call a prompt, moderated criticality in that fuel pool. It accounts for a lot of things we found, like plutonium being deposited on site. And, of course, TEPCO bulldozed a lot of that underground so that personnel wouldn't get overexposed. But there's also data that says that plutonium was found in, you know, chunks, not single atoms, but chunks of nuclear fuel were found 1 and 2 miles away. So in order to have that kind of an uplift force, I believe that the Unit 3 fuel pool had a prompt, moderated criticality.
Well, now, wasn't it Unit 3 that had 7% of its fuel was MOX fuel, in other words, mixed plutonium and uranium oxide? Was that Unit 3 fuel pool? And if so, was it in a Unit 3 reactor? If so, it must have been in the fuel pool as well, right?
Unit 3 had 30 test bundles of MOX fuel. So I don't think the MOX fuel dramatically changed anything. But you have to remember, all of these reactors, 1, 2, and 3, had been running for 4.5 years. So they had enormous amounts of plutonium. And MOX stands for mixed oxide, or fuel that's got plutonium in it. So all three reactors that were running had an enormous amount of plutonium in them, because that's what uranium-238 becomes when it sits in a nuclear reactor for a long period of time. I don't think the MOX fuel in Unit 3, perhaps it made a 1 or 2 or 3% difference, but in the big picture, the plutonium in Unit 3 came from Unit 3 being operated for 4.5 years.
Do you want to talk about the toxicity of plutonium, Arnie Gunderson?
I think you could better do that, but it's a very dangerous substance named after the god of hell.
Yeah, well, you know, it said a millionth of a gram will give you cancer if you inhale it. But in fact, when they injected plutonium into beagle dogs way back in the Manhattan Project, they didn't find a dose low enough that didn't give all the dogs cancer, which was probably 10 to the minus 9 grams, picogram amounts, incredibly tiny amounts. And plutonium's interesting. It's not absorbed from the gut generally in food, except in the neonatal gut because it's immature. And also it's more readily absorbed in chlorinated water, and much of our water is now chlorinated. It gets into the body mainly, though, through inhalation, through tiny particles entering the lung, where it can induce lung cancer. But then it's an interesting material. It's transferred by white blood cells called macrophages that eat it into the lymph glands in the centre of the chest. They're called mediastinal lymph glands, where it can mutate regulatory genes in cells to cause lymphomas. It is also an interesting material because the body thinks it's iron. It's an iron analogue. So it combines with the iron transporting protein called ferritin. And as such, it's transported and deposited in the liver, where there's a lot of iron, where it can induce liver cancer, to the bone where hemoglobin is made in the red blood cells, where it can cause bone cancer or leukemia or multiple myeloma. It has a predilection for testicles, and every male in the Northern Hemisphere has a tiny load of plutonium in his testicles from the weapons testing days, and the stuff's still falling down from the sky. And it tends to deposit just next to the spermatogonia, the cells that are the precursors of the sperm, where it can induce mutations like for cystic fibrosis or for hemochromatosis or diabetes or whatever you name it. And those mutations then can be passed on generation to generation. Meanwhile, the plutonium, because it's got a half-life of 24,400 years and lasts for quarter to half a million years, lives on. And if the man's cremated, the smoke goes out the chimney so another man can inhale it, and it could get into his testicles and induce similar mutations. So you could see plutonium can cause an exponential increase in deleterious genetic diseases down the time track. The other thing plutonium does, it lodges in the ovary as well, where it can do the same thing to genes in the eggs, but it also crosses the placenta. Now, the placenta lets nothing through. It's a very, very selective organ. But plutonium does get through because the body thinks it's iron, where it can lodge in a chromosomally genetically normal embryo and kill a cell that's going to form the left half of the brain or the right arm. And that's called teratogenesis. And that's what that drug thalidomide did when pregnant women took it to alleviate morning sickness, and their babies were born with gross deformities. I had a man who drove a bobcat on my land, and he had no arms. He just had legs, and he ran a radio station with his toes. And he was a thalidomide baby. The other very important thing for people to know about plutonium is each reactor manufactures at 500 pounds of it a year, and you only need 5 to 10 pounds to make a bomb. And as it lasts so long, any country with a reactor has an unlimited bomb factory for the rest of time. So kind of that rounds up plutonium. Do you have anything else to add, Arnie Gunderson?
Well, no, they've detected it as far as 100 kilometers away. In Japan. It's been detected 100 kilometers away from the reactor.
Now, isn't there some study that's been done recently, Arnie, that's detected plutonium hotspots falling out in Seattle and elsewhere?
There's hot particles that have definitely been detected in Seattle. Whether they're plutonium or not is unknown at the time, but they are physically highly radioactive particles that fell out both on Tokyo, Japan in general, but also as far away as Seattle. Now, there's a study coming out on Monday, October 31, and it's by the American Public Health Association, and it's a peer-reviewed paper. The person who's written it is Marco Caltafan at Worcester Polytechnic, and he determined that In Seattle, individuals were exposed to about 5 hot particles a day if they led a sedentary lifestyle.
Really?
Perhaps as high as 10 hot particles a day if they were physically active, joggers and stuff.
Really?
Like that.
5 to 10 a day? Over what period of time?
That's all of April.
All of April. And hot particles, when you say hot particles, do they measure the sort of radiation coming out? Alpha, beta, gamma, what was it?
That will be presented in the paper, and I don't have the details on that. The process was that they had a filter, and the pump that pulled 10 cubic meters a day through the filter, and then every day they changed the filter so that almost like a cigarette filter. And then they would roll the cigarette filter out and examine it with a scanning electron microscope, and they would find these hot particles. They also found that the same study that will be released on October 31 also found that in the Cascades, there was as much as 300 becquerels per kilogram of cesium-134 and 137 deposited on the soil. That's the Portland, Oregon area. And also, there's an awful lot of data in Japan as well. Car air filters were highly radioactive, and also children's shoes were highly radioactive. Now, all those details will come out in the paper, and it's going to be on the APHA, American Public Health Association, website.
When?
It'll be out November 1.
Uh-huh. Okay, so people should keep their eyes open for this. So as we talk, Arnie Gunderson, it seems to me that really the truth about the Fukushima accident is only filtering out in small aliquots all the time. But the overall picture seems to be one of an absolute total disaster, where there's a cover-up by the Japanese government, by the International Atomic Energy Agency, by TEPCO, by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, by the American government, about just how obscenely dangerous this accident has been, is, and will be. Would you like to comment on that statement, Arnie Gunderson?
I've been dealing with a lot of reporters in Japan, and Tokyo Electric has an enormous influence on the government of Japan. I think one of the reasons for the accident that it hasn't been paid for is that the government of Japan is afraid to drive Tokyo Electric into bankruptcy. But one way to get money to pay for a quicker cleanup would be to sell Tokyo Electric and use that cash to clean up Japan. And that doesn't seem to be on anybody's agenda. So clearly within Japan, there has been a hand-in-glove relationship between Tokyo Electric and the government. I've said before that the priority of Tokyo Electric was save Tokyo Electric, then maybe save the Japanese government, and if there were anything left, save the people of Japan. And I think the priority of the Japanese government was 1, save the government, 2, save TEPCO, and if there was anything left, save the people of Japan. So I think that the people of Japan have been at the bottom of both priorities for both the government and Tokyo Electric. I would agree with you, too. Here in the States, the accident is being minimized by both the regulators, the government, and obviously the nuclear reactor vendors.
That's obscene. I can't think of any other word to say but obscene. As I look at the study from the New York Academy of Sciences on Chernobyl and compare what the Russian government did in its haste and concern, it took a while, 10 days to get going, but it did get going, and compare that with the Japanese government and what they've done, the comparisons are quite startling. Would you say that, Arnie?
I actually think it's worse, because the population density in Japan is much higher than the population density in that part of Europe. So, yes, the Russians acted after the bureaucracy became aware of the magnitude of the problem. They got people out and kept people out.
Mm.
But there weren't as many people to move. Now, here's the Japanese who have more people and didn't move them. So I'm really concerned about the long-term health effects of the people of northern Japan.
Yes, well, there are 300,000 children still in Fukushima Prefecture, two-thirds of whom are going to school and living in areas where the Russians would have evacuated people already. And I know Japan's a crowded island and there are millions of people. There are, what, 30 million people in Tokyo or 50 million or something. But they could have evacuated those children who are so innately radio sensitive to southern parts of Japan that they just should have done it. And the thought that you can clean it up is a misnomer. You can't clean up radiation. Look, you can get bulldozers and you can bury some stuff and then it'll come up again in the plants and in the food and with rain and wind and everything. Lots of the areas in Fukushima Prefecture are mountainous, they're wooded, and as you've pointed out to me on numerous occasions, Arnie Gunderson, when it, you know, they might clean up a little village by bulldozing it and stuffing the stuff in a trench or something, but then when it rains, down comes more radiation and the water brings it down from the hills and the like. Do you want to talk about cleanup per se?
I absolutely agree with you that the children should have been moved out in the first couple of days. And I was on television here in the United States on CNN saying just that, you know, the women, childbearing age women, pregnant women and children should have been moved out immediately. And, you know, we have the example of during the Blitz back in the 1940s, what did the English do? They moved their children out. It's not unheard of that a population would go out of their way to protect the children. And I think the Japanese missed the opportunity and are continuing to miss the opportunity. These the photographs we've got of the children's shoes in the Fukushima Prefecture show that they're just loaded with cesium. And, you know, the shoelaces, and the kids get it on their hands, and then they get it in their throats.
Oh, God almighty.
On and on. It's a major concern to me is the damage they're doing to the children of Fukushima.
And the other thing is that nuclear accidents never end. I don't think people understand that apart from the fact that this thing is almost incurable and will go on for years and years and years emitting radiation, and if there are more earthquakes, God help everyone. But that the stuff that's already landed on the soil, cesium, strontium, we can go on and on, tellurium, neptunium, curium, and the like, stays there for hundreds of years. So, and it concentrates in the food. So people are eating radioactive food. When the cesium gets into their bodies, that stays in their bodies for a long period of time, years sometimes, irradiating just very small volumes of cells. So those cells continue to get a high dose. The people get a high dose. They're still eating radioactive food. They will then die of their cancers or whatever they die of, or heart disease or diabetes, and many things can be caused by radiation. And then the next generation will be born probably exposed in utero to the radioactive poisons because their mothers are eating radioactive food, drinking radioactive milk. And then it goes on, and cesium lasts for 600 years. Therefore, there are three generations per century. So you could say 18 generations will be exposed just to cesium-137 itself. And it's important to note also that 40% of Europe is still radioactive from Chernobyl. What really staggers me, Arnie, as a pediatrician, I guess, is that this is so irreversible. And once it happens, it's happened. There's nothing anyone can do about it. And people, I'm sure it's happened to you, have been ringing me saying, what can I give my children to eat? What blocks radiation? What gets radiation out of bodies? So have people been approaching you about that?
You know, you're right. We're Dr. Steve Wing, an epidemiologist who's been on our site, said, you know, we are all at risk. Obviously, the Japanese are worse, but we're at a point now where we can't run and we can't hide.
Yeah.
And we get frequent questions, you know, what should I do? should I take a Geiger counter to the supermarket? And we're at a point where it's evenly distributed everywhere, except in Japan and the Cascades of North America, but the rest of the world. And we have basically, you know, committed that people are going to die of cancer worldwide because we've spread out this radioactivity essentially globally. And you're right. There's it's not something you can clean up. There's things the Japanese should be doing to prevent it from getting worse. Especially, you know, they burn their rice. After the rice is harvested, they burn the stalks of the straw. And it concerns me that they're in the process throwing back up the cesium that's already wound up on the ground. Now, there's a lot of things they can do to prevent it from moving.
Yeah.
But basically, you're absolutely right, Helen, that we all know the moment Chernobyl began, but tell me the moment it ended, and there is no end.
Now, the rice is just starting to be harvested, and they're finding cesium-137 in the rice. And the rice is more than just food for the Japanese. It's almost a spiritual symbol, isn't it, rice? And
There's also some indications that there was some 2010 rice that was slipped into the process to make some of the rice pass the test.
Diluting it. Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, there were some people that did see bags from 2010 in the same area as bags from 2011, and it appeared that they were blending it.
Yeah, I think I saw that. Now, talk about the radioactive sewage. Why is the sewage in Tokyo and elsewhere radioactive? How did the radiation get into the sewage system? And what are the Japanese deciding to do about the sewage system, Arnie Gunderson, and the radioactive sewage?
Well, we're working with some people in Tokyo who have a filter on their house. And the filter, they send the filter to the lab we work with, and every month they examine the filter. The filters from the summer were less radioactive than the filter they removed on October 1st. So what's happening is that the radiation in the air in Tokyo has actually increased in September compared to back in the summer. And I think what's happening is that, you know, one is the releases from the plant, but two is the burning of nuclear material around the country in order to minimize its effect on your particular property, they burn it. So what we're seeing is all this contamination now falls on the ground, runs into sewers, and contaminates the sewage systems. The Japanese concentrate their sewage by incineration, and they're coming up with high quantities of radioactive sewage sludge, so high that it needs a solution, but there is no solution. So it's sitting outside in large under gigantic tarps, and of course every day the tarps get larger and larger and larger. There's no solution right now to it. They're talking about the equivalent of 50 football fields full, 50 feet high, 20 meters high, 50 football fields full of contaminated sewage sludge is a likely outcome here, and there's no place to put it.
And so they're burning it.
That's after they burn it.
That's after they burn it.
Yes, after they burn it, the consolidated sludge is so radioactive that it could easily fill 50 football fields.
Good God.
Now, what they used to do with it, Helen, is make cinder blocks for buildings. But the last thing you want to do now is have a radioactive building.
But so there are two things happening then, Arnie Gunderson. First, by burning the radioactive sewage, they're dispersing radioactive elements into the air all over Japan, depending upon the wind direction. And two, they're left with a concentrated sludge or ash after burning, which is also very radioactive. I mean, God almighty. And the radiation in the sewage is actually coming from water draining off the fields and off the concrete and off the roads, which are contaminated with radioactive fallout, and then it gets into the sewage system. Is that correct? Is that where it comes from?
You're absolutely right. This is very gloomy prospect here. You're going to lose viewers.
Viewers? I don't have viewers. We only have listeners, Arnie.
Okay. Well, you're absolutely right, though, Helen, that there's no solution here. The Japanese don't know where to put this material, just like they don't know where to put the higher-level nuclear fuel. You know, the Japanese never had a plan for a nuclear fuel repository, like, you know, some sort of deep underground storage for nuclear fuel. The theory in Japan was that they would recycle. They would use liquid sodium reactors and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
So after Fukushima, that whole concept has broken down, and now the Japanese have to face the fact that they're on a seismically unstable island, and where are they going to put the nuclear fuel, the spent nuclear fuel? They had a deal with Mongolia. They were working on a contract with Mongolia to store it in Mongolia. But just last week, the Mongolian government canceled the deal because the quantities of radioactive material were becoming extraordinarily high.
Okay, now we've got 5 minutes. If you were president of the United States right now, Arnie Gunderson, what would you do?
First off, the Mark I reactors should be shut down. There's 35 around the world. There's 23 in the United States. And the risk from a Mark I reactor is just way too high. You know, I think, though, we need some sort of a vision. Rather than spend money on enormous single-unit nuclear plants, like building a Maginot line of power plants to fight last year's battle, I think there's three things on the horizon. The first is we can conserve. I mean, here's Tokyo. Tokyo had 16% less power, and they're still there. You know, they got by. They turned lights out, and they cut the air conditioning back, and everybody survived. But so we can conserve, and we can be more efficient. The second thing is renewables, and I think between, you know, solar and wind and hydroelectric and things like that, we can generate a lot of power. And the third thing is a smart grid, where we can distribute the power. You know, we didn't have that in the 20th century, but in the 21st century with computers, we can move power more easily. So, you know, for instance, Japan's a big country, so you could put windmills offshore, and where the wind isn't blowing, it's going to be blowing somewhere else, and you can distribute that power with a smart grid.
Mm.
So I really think Japan or the United States needs an approach to say, okay, we're going to be more efficient. We don't need another power plant in the United States for 30 years if we just became as efficient as the French.
Well, so if you were President Arnie Gunderson, wouldn't that be great? And Maggie would be the First Lady. Would you close down all the reactors within a certain period of time, 104 reactors in America? Would you close them down, Arnie?
Well, we've got the 23 Mark I's that I definitely think should be shut down immediately. You know, and we have a deal is a deal, and we've got the remaining reactors have 40-year lives, and I think we should let them run out their 40-year lives.
Well, you do? Oh, boy, if I were president, and I wouldn't have a First Lady, I'd shut them all down because Americans waste 28% of the electricity they currently use. Nuclear power only generates 20% of the electricity. So, as you pointed out, you know, if you have to save like they did in Tokyo, that you can. And, you know, electricity is an imperative for us to survive. And, you know, we could... There are so many ways to save electricity, but that's for another day, I think, to talk about that. Anyway, look, President Arnie Gunderson, we've run out of time, but thanks so much for this update. You know that your programs attract so many viewers because people are absolutely hungry for this information, Arnie, as you well know. And you're a national treasure. You and Maggie, you're national treasures, and one day you will be terribly appreciated.
Well, thank you, and please send your viewers to the Fairwinds website. And there's a little donate button there. We would sure appreciate a hand.
Yes, Arnie needs money. He's not being paid for this wonderful service he's providing, whereas the people on Wall Street give themselves bonuses of millions of dollars. So it's time Arnie got bonuses for the work he's doing. So anyway, thanks again, Arnie, and we will talk to you in the near future.
Thanks, Helen. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Arne Gundersen, an energy advisor with 39 years of nuclear power engineering experience in the United States.
I'm not feeling too good tonight. Nothing I'm doing ain't sitting right. It's got nothing to do with the way I see it. I just can't stop thinking about you. I get in the car and go for a drive, and I change it up for a little while. Then I turn around and I do it again, but I just can't find a friend. Didn't I know it moved so slow until I see you again? I ain't going to work today. I'll stay right here and dream away. I might have
track was Until I See You Again by the Dennis Boys Band. Thanks for listening again today, and we'll be back with you next week with another fascinating program. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.